Good evening, New York. Thank you for tuning in to The Rundown on WNYU 89.1 FM here in New York City and online everywhere on WNYU.org. I'm your host, Aria Yang, and today we have four fantastic stories for you. So buckle up. First, we will hear from the first Trader Joe's store to unionize in New York. And then we'll hear about the controversial Birds Aren't Real protest in Washington Square Park this past weekend. And after that, we have a story about the Iranian protests following Mahsa Amini's death and NYU student solidarity with the protesters. And finally, we will learn about the legendary Cyphers. It's a unique Friday hip-hop experience in Union Square Park. So without further ado, let's dive into our first story. The unionization movement is something that we've been covering a lot on The Rundown. So you might remember that our news director, Grace Wanabo, covered the NYU adjunct professors' union strike last semester. And this past summer, I did a piece about Starbucks firing their union leaders as a union busting tactic. You might also remember that in the Rundown episode, also in August, we discussed the abrupt closing of Trader Joe's wine shop in Union Square. And at the time, we didn't really have an explanation or just any clue of what was going on, like why did it close. But apparently the surprise closure was union related. And recently a Trader Joe's in Williamsburg officially unionized. So what does that mean for a new post-pandemic consciousness of labor rights, especially in New York City? Isabella LaPlante and Sabrina Lee have the story.
We really did look at Trader Joe's, the company values, the company culture, and want to, you know, preserve that and also hold the company to account to their own values through unionizing.
That was Sarah Beth Rither from Minneapolis.
My apologies. Technical difficulty. So let me start the piece again.
Did look at the full Trader Joe's.
The full story.
We really did look at Trader Joe's, the company values, the company culture, and want to, you know, preserve that and also hold the company to account to their own values through unionizing.
That was Sarah Beth Rither from Minneapolis, an employee organizer with Trader Joe's United, or TJU. As of now, two locations in Minnesota and Massachusetts have successfully unionized. A Trader Joe's in Williamsburg, the first in New York, is now voting to join the lot. This was incited by reports of management unfairly targeting workers of color and insufficient employee benefits. We are joined by another TJU organizer, Meg Yosef, who helped with the first unionization in Hadley, Massachusetts.
We've heard from so many crew members who are interested in unionizing their stores, and Williamsburg is the most recent store to file for a union election, so we're really excited to have them on board.
These efforts are a part of a wave of unionization that has been happening in New York City and nationwide. This was prompted by the pandemic, leading to discussions of essential workers' rights.
I think that the pandemic was 2 years of people either being frontline workers or sitting in their houses with a lot of time to think about how work and their identity converge and what that and also what we deserve as workers. And that's been a larger national conversation that used to take place. I know that there are a lot of unionized Starbucks right now with unionization efforts happening all around the city, that people feel resources are at their fingertips versus being some abstract concept that is difficult to enter.
Trader Joe's has suppressed New York City unionization efforts, firing a black organizer at Williamsburg. They also unexpectedly closed the Trader Joe's wine store on 14th Street after unionization buzz.
The wine store was poised to unionize. They had enough support, and they were just about a week away, from what I understand, from submitting cards to the NLRB, which means that Trader Joe's corporate's decision to close the store, we interpret it as a direct crushing of a union effort.
the store was closed pretty much overnight, that crew actually went to work in the morning, some of them, and, you know, to find that their store was closed, so...
If Williamsburg decides to unionize, Meg thinks it could lead to something bigger for Trader Joe's workers nationwide.
It feels to me like a tipping point of like, okay, there's Hadley. No one even knows where Hadley is. There's Minneapolis, but like New York's like having a third store join. To me, it feels like there's so much more momentum.
Call this movement what it is. It's for freedom of speech. It's for freedom of bodily autonomy.
Oops, apologies again. That was actually the beginning of our final piece, but we will get to that soon. So our next, so that was the story from Isabella LaPlante and Sabrina Lee about the Trader Joe's Union in New York City. So our next one is something that happened this past Saturday. So members of the Birds Aren't Real movement flocked to Washington Square Park to protest government surveillance. Amaya McDuffie has the story.
If you visited Washington Square Park this past Saturday, October 15th, then you might have seen a large group congregating near the arch, or you may have heard them. This group of hundreds of people holding signs like Big Bird is watching you, It's a lie, and Unite Against Government Drones gathered for a protest hosted by the conspiracy group Birds Aren't Real. The group was founded by Peter McIndoe as a quote spontaneous joke after he witnessed counter-protesters at a 2017 Women's March touting conspiratorial signs. McIndoe wrote Birds Aren't Real on a poster and created the conspiracy theory on a whim amongst the pro-Trump protesters, and thus the movement was born. Since then, with the help of social media, the theory has gained exponential amounts of recognition and support, culminating in this Saturday's gathering, which the group states was their, quote, biggest protest ever. In between boos directed at flocks of birds circulating the park, I talked to some protesters.
I'm Ava. I'm with the Birds Aren't Real movement. So we're gathering here just to show solidarity with our awareness that birds are just government surveillance drones. You know, there have been lots of conversations around government surveillance states, specifically like regarding the internet, you know, as the government has more capability to like surveil its citizens. Well, what's acceptable and what's not? And I think I'm personally here to let people know that we know what the government is doing. And we know that even though there are more overt ways of surveillance in place already, that we're on to the bird conspiracy, and we know.
I asked Ava what led her to believe that birds are government surveillance drones.
Well, I mean, it's obvious. Have you ever seen birds? Like, have you ever looked at birds? It's weird. Like, they just migrate in packs of hundreds. Like, sometimes they even look like they're malfunctioning. Like, you can tell that they're waiting for a software update.
Others gave me different explanations.
I mean, have you ever seen a baby bird?
I think so, yeah.
There's tons of proof. You can check it out online. Go to Birds Aren't Real's website. Check it all. There's too much to cover here today. Every bird has been replaced by the government with surveillance drones. As you can see, this diagram here.
The person I'm interviewing shows me his sign.
These are seabirds, and then they equal spying eyes.
Despite the outpouring of support for the movement, some took issue with the protest. A group of counter-protesters stood in opposition to the anti-bird sentiments, holding signs reading, "Birds aren't real equals PSYOP. Birds are real." However, according to Washington Square News, the counter-protesters are rumored to be hired actors. But others have a different issue with the protest. Jazz Wingard is a freshman at Barnard. I spoke to her and Sally Thistle, a freshman at Temple University, on the outskirts of the protest about their concerns.
I think it's offensive. I think it's mocking the art of protest, which black people and queer people have been doing for ages, because it's the only way we're able to have our voices heard, and people just want to go and take that for fun, just for something to do, just a reason to be mad instead of being mad at the actual systems that are perpetuating violence and trauma and hate.
I feel honestly very taken aback. Just seeing this being protested and people looking at this and filming it is really hard for me to see, because I feel like there's so many other issues going on right now, and the thing that they're trying to highlight is this, and you can see people around are amused by it. But if this was a protest about an issue that was important, like an issue like maybe abortion, like what would the media, how it would react? People who are in the protest are so stuck on this idea, and I'm like, don't you see there's other important things going on? Like, so much more energy can be put into something else.
I'm Amaya McDuffie. This is The Rundown.
Birds aren't real! Birds aren't real!
Thank you, Amaya. So that was the Birds Aren't Real story. And the next story we have for you is something that has been gaining a lot of attention globally, and rightfully so. So as you have heard, following the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman, protests erupted all over Iran against the legal and social restrictions on women that have been set in place for over 30 years. To gain a deeper perspective on what is happening in Iran and its implications, Adelaide Miller and Rogine Groves spoke with several NYU students and an Iranian woman who fled Iran during the revolution.
It's for religious freedom. It's for the freedom to protest. It's for women's rights. It's for basic human rights. We refuse to let this movement die down, and we will keep it alive on social media and in our voices and hearts until we see actionable change. So I ask you to repeat after me. Baraye zan zendegi azadi. Baraye zan zendegi azadi. Baraye jin jiyan azadi. Baraye jin jiyan azadi. For woman, life, freedom. For woman, life, freedom. Thank you.
That was Kiana Naderi, a vice president of NYU's Persian Cultural Society. She spoke at the NYU vigil for Mahsa Amini that took place in Kimmel Center on October 12th. Mahsa Amini was a 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman who died in the custody of Iran's morality police in late September. Her death has sparked public outrage and protests for women's rights in Iran and across the world. Here at NYU, her story is deeply personal to many students who are members of the Iranian diaspora. They're fighting to elevate the message of Iranian protesters. Some students say that NYU has a responsibility to use its influence in support of their cause, but that the university is failing to do so.
These protests are not unheard of in Iran. Specifically, after the Iranian Revolution and overthrow of the Shah of Iran, Iran underwent a series of protests in light of the new leadership. After what seemed like a never-ending fight to preserve Iran as a democratic nation it was, on February 11th of 1979, Mohammad Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran at the time, was overthrown and a new theocratic republican society dominated. This society reversed both societal and legal rights that women had won, now restricting what they could study in school and how they could dress on the streets. Women were mandated to wear hijabs both on the streets and while in the presence of men, pushing them further away from their right of self-expression. From that moment on, there has been little to no change to the political structure of Iran. The same theocratic republican society still dominates, and women are expected to abide by the rules set in stone over 30 years ago. The death of Mahsa Amini ignited the built-up anger of Iranian women. It represents a turning point in Iranian history, empowering people in their homes to protest on the streets, in schools, and anywhere likely to gather the attention of those in power.
Here's Dr. Sarah Rezegi. She studied as a physician in Tehran before leaving the country during the 1979 revolution. We spoke to her about life before the revolution and her perspective on the protests happening there today.
We were able to choose whatever we would like to study, and we had in all levels, pilots, we had policemen, we had everything, in every single factory we had women, in every single university and different majors. We had women in all specialty in medicine. We have women when revolutionary and only can go to OB-GYN or internal medicine or pediatrics. They cannot go to any other major in medicine. They are totally suppressed. But this is not the woman. They do it for all elderly, for kids. This is just the revolution came from the heart of a young generation, which they were so sick and tired. And the good thing about now, in 1979, there was no internet. We didn't know what's going on outside of the country. Now they have access. They know how the other young people in other country, they have freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of when they leave the house, no one dictated them what to wear. And this lady who was killed, she had all government dictated clothes. A few parts of the front hair was out. That's why they killed her. But she now is every single young woman, boys and girls, is the symbol of that woman which was killed, Mahsa Amini. And in these days, they say every single one of us is Mahsa Amini.
In Iran, this movement has been driven by large numbers of young people, many of them college-aged or younger. Anti-revolutionary government, police, and military forces targeted student protesters at the top university's Sharif Institute of Technology in early October, arresting and shooting student protesters with both lethal and non-lethal artillery. At the NYU vigil, several students reflected on the violent attack that the Sharif Institute students experienced.
My mom called me, like, crying on the phone just because the women in Iran are, like, the most educated out of any other country in the Middle East, and an attack on such a sacred institution in just more than one way, I don't know, it's like heartbreaking. It's terrifying.
There's a voice memo that's going viral on Instagram, and it's the voice of one of the students that's at the university, and I was like bawling my eyeballs out because hearing her voice, I'm literally on the verge of crying right now, but this girl's voice was so heartbreaking.
After students came together at the vigil to honor Mahsa Amini and the movement that she inspired, some students expressed that they felt dissatisfied with the level of support that the university has shown to its Iranian students and the Iranian protest efforts. Here's one NYU student who asked to remain anonymous.
This entire movement is the first recorded female-led revolution, and it's become an actual... It's entering the stages of a true revolution, and I don't think... this vigil touched on it enough, and I want to bring attention to this. It's kind of atrocious that NYU is maintained its neutrality. They've been very quick to jump onto a lot of political and a lot of other movements, and this one they've remained silent on for be it internal political reasons. Again, NYU is a small nation. They don't talk about this enough. It is quite literally 30,000 students. A healthy amount of them are international, so it does make sense that they have to balance politics and running a school, but it's outrageous that they, especially Andy Hamilton, has maintained his silence on this entire event and unfolding of basically history. And this has the ability to reshape global politics and global relations as we know it, and the silence is deafening.
Students at the vigil emphasized that the best way for people outside of Iran to support protesters in Iran is to listen to and reflect the voices of Iranian people on social media. People can also join online projects focused on providing open internet access to Iranians through platforms such as the We Are Mahsa Amini page on GitHub. From New York City to Tehran, here are some of the messages that NYU students would want to share with Iranian protesters.
It might feel like they're up against the whole entire structure of their country because they are, but people beyond their borders see how hard they're fighting, and they are as aware as they are that it's a cause worth fighting for.
Keep fighting. Don't stop. There's no time to stop. You're on a revolutionary break. Keep busting your ass. It's going to be worth it. I'm praying it's worth it. You guys can do this. We support you 100%. And keep fighting for your rights, because no one else is going to do it other than you.
I would just say keep going, and I would be there with you if I could.
To the student protesters, Boro, in Koskesar, Bekosh, do whatever you need to do. Get them. Fight tooth and nail. If I was there, I'd be doing the same as you. Make sure that you do it and make sure it never comes out. Cut the snake's head off, please.
These protests are ongoing, and NYU students continue to show solidarity and demand recognition from the university. For WNYU 89.1 FM, this has been Adelaide Miller
and Rogine Groves
for The Rundown.
Thank you, Adelaide, Rogine, and Harmony, who helped with the story. This is such a powerful story just by itself, and I think we as student media here at The Rundown and at WNYU, I feel like we have a responsibility to echo such a significant moment in history. So I'm really glad that we did that piece, and I think that, and I'm really glad that NYU students, at least, I'm not saying the administration is the same, but definitely NYU students and definitely students, student leaders here at WNYU, we are all advocates of liberation and human rights everywhere. And we stand in solidarity with the Iranian women who are leading the protest right now. And I really hope that the movement will lead to some actual solidified change. So yeah, so after that, after such a heavy but extremely important story, we have a fun culture piece to close out the show. So last but not least, we are going to hear from Pasha Tobe and M. Ingram about Union Square's legendary cipher.
When the sun down, shout out to NYU, we giving y'all the rundown.
With WNYU's The Rundown, I'm M. Ingram.
And I'm Pasha Tobe. For those NYU students who have passed through Union Square on any given Friday night, you might have maneuvered past a sizable and engaged crowd, not thinking twice about it. That crowd might have actually been the legendary cipher, an open mic-style hip-hop cipher that gathers outside the 14th Street subway station every Friday night.
From 8 p.m. to midnight, battle rappers from across New York City congregate in a circle, freestyling about anything from their day-to-day experiences to Dragon Ball Z, all to make their name known within the tightly knit community. We interviewed two of the Cypher's hosts, Mickey and Eli, to understand how the Cypher came to be and what it stands for.
My name is Mickey. Now I represent Legendary Cyphers.
Yo, peace. It's Eli Black representing Legendary Cyphers. Well, Legendary Cyphers, it started in 2013. It was started by Daniel Majesty Sanchez, as well as a few other people who were just trying to, you know, keep the cypher energy alive in New York City. There weren't really any cyphers going on at that time consistently. And Majesty saw it. He saw what it was, and he saw the potential of it. He decided, like, rather than doing it just a couple of times over the summer, we should make it like a whole season of it and continue to do it throughout the year. So
when it comes to the ciphers, you know, we've been doing it for the past 9 years. Throughout the years, you know, we turn strangers into friends and friends into family. You see somebody that you don't know, and now all of a sudden they become best friends. We had two people that met each other there, and then they got married. Now they have a family together. Random celebs have popped out to the cipher too. And it's all like freestyle. So it's like, yo, you don't know what you expect to see there or what to hear. It could be like things that are trending right now, or it could be political. It could be like just out of the world type of rhymes, or someone's going through something that week, or battles might break out. But then at the end, we'll be like, yo, just give each other a pound or a hug and just keep it moving. And that's the dope part about the cipher being weekly too, because you can't expect the same thing over and over, because something mad random could happen. You were like, wow, you know, I might want to come back next week.
Pasha and I had to attend last Friday's cipher to see for ourselves just how random the outcome really is.
You need cash now.
Begin though, I laced up my Timbos. I saw an open window.
A dolphin in the crowd.
Hey,
Other than listening to people counting numbers and making dolphin noises, we also heard some incredible bars in various languages, covering all sorts of topics, including a 15-minute Pokemon rap battle, which we particularly enjoyed. While there, we also asked some participants what they thought of the cypher.
Yeah, we're at the cypher. Let me tell you why I'm here. My name is Roger, and they call me Normal. That's my superhero code name, you know what I mean? Normal. I've just been coming out here for years and having a good time. It's like a sport to me. It's my social life. I catch up with my homies. This is fun to me. You know what I mean? I live a busy life, and this is somewhere I can express myself and let loose and hang out a little bit.
What's going on? My name is Dimitri. I like to come to the site because it's therapeutic, and everybody is all different walks of life, black, brown, Asian. It's a form of art at the end of the day. And you come here to sharpen your sword with different people from different backgrounds. And the best thing, besides exercising your body, is exercising your mind.
The strong sense of camaraderie at last Friday's cypher demonstrated the fulfillment of Daniel Sanchez's hopes for the cypher to establish a foundation for freedom and creativity for all.
As for, like, community building tool, Majesty created this tool because he wanted to bridge the gap between activism and hip-hop. He worked in organizations like the Justice Committee, you know, Cop Watch and other organizations. And, you know, as for myself, like, I work with communities too. Like, I work with youth. And, you know, sometimes I bring the youth out and tell them to come out if they want to rap or something, you know. And that's something that is a beautiful thing.
Despite Daniel Majesty Sanchez's tragic passing in October of 2016, Mickey, Eli, and the whole community have been able to keep his legacy alive through the cypher for 6 years and counting.
I think the beauty of what Majesty did was that because he was like mixing the activism world and the hip hop world, we have this like grassroots foundation within us. Me and Mickey know each other from a guy named Spirit Child, who was also an activist and an MC and a teacher. The cypher itself is like 1000% straight up, just like raw, organic, grassroots. He just left us with so much just guidance, I would say. We're taking those same lessons and like applying it to the cypher, whether it be directly rapping about certain topics or just taking the opportunity to build with people and talk with them.
Over the years, celebrities including P. Diddy and Saul Williams have made an appearance at the cypher. Recently, as the community has grown, Mickey and Eli have found their own recognition within the New York rap scene.
We had three kids that came out here, right, that they say they grew up watching us. I was in awe because I'm like, wow, you know, it's like, we're not even celebs or nothing, but in their eyes, maybe we are. Maybe it's just like, it's an incredible thing to know that what we're doing is actually is impactful, you know, and people noticing stuff.
In those moments, I don't really know how to react when somebody comes up to you and they're like, yo, I've been watching you since I was 14. And then they're like 18, 19 years old now. It just shows the power of what we do and the community, even beyond, you know, those who can physically be there with us in the park on Fridays. Like, the community just expands worldwide, and it's just, I just love it, honestly.
For anyone who may be interested in getting involved or spectating, there are 5 more cyphers this year up until November 18th.
For those who are interested but cannot physically attend, cyphers are also live-streamed and recorded on Legendary Cypher's YouTube channel and accessible through their Instagram account at LegendaryCyphers360. With WNYU's The Rundown, this has been M. Ingram
and Pasha Tobe.
Welcome to a legendary cypher. Be legendary.
Oh, that was fire!
Thank you, Pasha and M. That was all for our stories tonight. So for our historical fact of the day, if you're still listening, on this day in 2018, the Halloween film reboot starring Jamie Lee Curtis makes a record of $77 million for a horror film with a female lead. That was the biggest debut of any film with female lead over 55, actually, in the U.S. I think Halloween Ends is the recent film that just came out. I think that's like the end of a Halloween trilogy, I think. And that's like, what, like the 13th movie or something? I'm not entirely sure, but like the 13th movie of the entire Halloween franchise. And I've heard mixed opinions about it, but I'm not super into horror films. But if you would like to review the film, let us know if you have opinions about Halloween Ends. Email me. All right. And on that note, that's all for the rundown tonight. If you liked what you heard, want to hear something different, or if you want to submit a tip for a story, you can email me at associatenews@wnyu.org. I hope you enjoy the show today. I will be here next Wednesday, 7 p.m. to bring you more local alternative news. I'm Aria Young, and this has been the Rundown on WNYU 89.1 FM.